Welcome back to the Lyme Podcast. My name is Aaron Alexander. This is a place that we bring together the world's leading experts in all things health and wellness to help you optimize your mind, body, and movement. Today's conversation is all about breathing, how to breathe well, why it matters in the first place, how to improve your nasal specific breathing, exercises to improve the mechanics of your breathing. This is something that commonly is missed in the world of breath work or yoga or breathing practices in general, is respiratory efficiency, or just how well you are breathing in the first place. Where should your ribs be? Where should your pelvic floor be? Neck, shoulders, different styles of breathing. It is with Jill Miller. She is the queen of breath. Really dig her a lot. She just put out a book called Body by Breath. It is encyclopedic in nature and is fantastic. I think you guys should check that out as well. Thank you for subscribing to each week's episodes. Thank you for leaving us reviews. Thank you for sharing this conversation. I think this is one you want to take notes for. I think this is one to send to your loved ones. If you care about their health, then you ought to care about their breath. And I think this is a great resource to support them. That's it. That's all. Let's get to it with Jill Miller. Jill Miller, what are people missing in the realm of how can we breathe more efficiently? What does efficient breathing meaning? Like, what does that mean in the first place? When you see someone go to a yoga class, we're all huffing and puffing, we're breathing, we're doing like a holotropic thing or a Wim Hof thing, or we're doing something that involves respiration, which is ultimately everything. What are the key points in the body that you see? It's like, oh, if you would have just adjust your ribs a little bit, your pelvis a little bit, or your shoulders a little bit, like, what do we need to know about the mechanics of breathing right?
If you would just adjust, we have this running joke in my home, and there's never just adjust. And that could be spelled a few different ways. So your breathing muscles exist in three different neurological zones of the body, or the muscles of respiration correlate to your stress state. And in this book that I've just published called Body by Breath, I divide it into three separate zones. So let me talk you through the zones, because I think once you hear the layout of these different muscular respiratory drivers, because really respiration is being driven by the brain stem. But the response of the, which muscles are the ones that are chiefly responsible for bringing air in and out, is going to differ based on physical environment and emotional stressful environment. So let's go into the three zones of respiration, and then we can talk about maybe what people are or are not doing in different breathwork practices that might be perpetuating pain for them. So the three different zones of respiration. Thing one is we have to acknowledge this amazing skeletal muscle called the respiratory diaphragm is the big kahuna of breathing. So you have this sort of misshapen trampoline. I mean, it's shaped just right, but it's this odd-shaped trampoline or parachute that's living inside the lower six ribs. It's a little bit bigger on the right side, a little higher because of your liver. And it's a little lower on the left side. And breathing happens because this diaphragm is contracting and relaxing. In a zone one breath, this is a breath that's going to occur in the area below the rib cage. So in a zone one breath, the muscles of the respiratory diaphragm is the chief driver of a zone one breath. And in a zone one breath, as the diaphragm descends, the stuff below the diaphragm must distend. There must be a relative expansion of the gut, right? So if you put your hand on your belly or you put your hands on your waist and you breathe in right now in a zone one breath, in a calm state breath, there should be an expansion of the belly, the waist, the low back, even the pelvic floor, right? As this pressure is descending down. So we think of the transversus abdominis, which is that cummerbund muscle, as a reciprocal tissue of respiration for zone one. But all of the elastic tissues down here are. I mean, even we can even look at your organs as a reciprocal tissue of respiration, right? If I have a lot of not, I had a lot of backup in my gut. Like I had a relative just have surgery. She had shoulder replacement surgery and she was compacted. She hadn't had a bowel movement in 7 days. She was having difficulty breathing and she was having agonizing pain, right? The stiffness in her viscera was not allowing the elasticity of the diaphragm to do its thing. That's a whole other story, but you can see how everything below the diaphragm needs to be able to respond in a zone one breath. And a zone one breath is going to create a relaxation response. It's going to make me parasympathetically dominant. A zone two breath is a collaboration between the respiratory diaphragm and the intercostals. You know intercostals. I know you'd be an omnivore. You've eaten ribs. We have these external and internal intercostals that help swing the ribs up on inhale and help them to peter down on an exhale. And
it's like a bucket handle.
Yeah, it's described as a bucket handle in the mid ribs. It's described as a pump handle in the higher ribs. Yeah. So we have these different ways that the ribs can rotate, they can articulate. And if my breathing happens in zone two, I'm in a more upregulated state. I'm a more sympathetically driven individual at that experience. And one needs to be able to have a dynamically moving rib cage for health, for their back health, to be able to also breathe when I need to brace. So if I need to brace my zone one because I'm lifting something heavy, you know, you don't want your abdomen, your low back and your pelvis to be unstable when you're lifting heavy things. So I need to be able to brace my zone one muscles and I need to be able to breathe into my zone two in an active effort, right? An active push, an active pull. But if somebody is a chronic zone two breather, like say you're trying to look skinny all the time, so you're pulling your abdomen in so that you don't have that the gut balloon. But yeah, overtraining can create that lack of elasticity in the transversus abdominis and obliques. Overtraining can stiffify the low back musculature to the extent that I don't really get a good excursion in zone one, but I might have scar tissue in my zone one from a C-section, an appendectomy, low back surgery. So I might have inappropriate stiffness throughout my zone one because of an injury or a trauma there. Yeah. So it might be my personality. I want to look skinny. So I stiffen my zone one. Any of these are going to make me a chronic zone two breather. So the point of saying this, what's a chronic zone two breather end up doing? They often will quickly deflect into a zone three breather. So zone three breathing is the type of breathing we do in case of emergency. And it's totally necessary. So if you take your hands and you wrap them around the tops of your collarbones and shoulders right now, and you take a breath in that's a where the shoulders elevate, it's a quick, typically a gasp, fright, shock, fear. It's often an open mouth type of breath, but this is also the type of breath we have in delight or in orgasm. So it's not like always diabolical to be a zone three breather. It happens out of necessity. But what you see in people who have sports-induced asthma or folks with asthma is that they will be using these muscles of the face, neck, and head to try to get breath in. And these tissues can become so rigid and tight and miserable. So we have these three different zones that are helping us to generate air in and air out. And it's really the interplay of how we can consciously use them, because unconsciously, you know, happens unconsciously. But what can we do on a day-to-day basis to be able to be a better wind instrumentalist of our own breathing muscles so that we don't end up creating unnecessary pain and suffering?
I think it's interesting that I've heard you, I think it's probably in your book, or maybe I heard you say it, but we're breathed by our brains. That interplay between the brainstem and, you know, that bridge between the conscious and the unconscious, I think is very interesting. And I wonder, where does one start the journey into their breath? Is it a psycho-emotional exploration is, could there be some type of deep held anxiety or trauma or something of the sort that's causing me to not be able to breathe in a way that actually indicates safety? Or is it something where I can mechanically move in and start to bring some more tissue hydration and elasticity and responsivity to the tissues that would allow the body to breathe in a way that would indicate safety? Or does it even matter? Is it all a matter that you get started with the journey into the body, into the self?
Well, I think that your, you know, students or clients or people listening to this, you know, if they're intrigued by breath practices, what I have seen, I mean, I think there's those people that are like, I really just want to try breathing. I've heard it can be amazing. I heard it can be life-changing. I heard it can decode all of my mental stuff. But quite often, one thing that can happen when people are struggling with pain is breathing can become over time very shallow and unfulfilling. And so then when they start to place attention on breathing, breathing is kind of a rebel and it doesn't want you to look at it. It becomes very self-conscious and it becomes even more self-aware of the challenge of breathing mechanics. What I'm referring to here is breath-induced anxiety. So when you start to like put a spotlight on something so automatic, it's like if I said to you, okay, Aaron, I want you to spotlight on your blood flow right now. Let's see if we can make a change in that blood flow all over your body. It's a little stressful to even think about it, but through conscious practices, we can actually do things that can alter our heartbeat, right? By the way, breathing and position and palpation are some of those things that can do that. But breathing is so raw because you can regulate it. It's automatic, but it's also a regulatory thing. So when I have folks come in to a class or studio and they're like, I really want to tackle the breathing thing. And if I start working with them and I can see that my breath cues or my coaching are not helping them to find a rhythm that they can actually overtake, like riding a stallion almost. What I'll do is I'll actually step aside and we'll do palpation or positional based work and tell them, don't worry about the breathing. The breathing is going to come along for the ride. I don't want you to try to control it. Let's use some ball work, right? So I have these squishy pliable balls.
Gorgeous ball.
Yes, all different sizes. But this one, the gorgeous ball, this inflated one, is so good for creating biofeedback of giving your body something to work against. And I usually find that within minutes, people can get a hold of a respiratory pattern that can then ultimately alter state and that we can start to build on these changing mechanics. Did I answer your question there?
You started to. I think like what's the highest leverage route to start the conversation into breathing mechanics? Is it actual structural, physical, get a ball in there, lie on it, create some biofeedback, breathe into those places, and that will end up inducing a more probably parasympathetic state for the nervous system. Suddenly they'll feel calm. They'll feel like they have the autonomic safety to be able to have the spaciousness to breathe. Or could there be another path if a person's been in kind of like more of a shallow zone 3 breathing pattern for a long time? They're not able to get a full exhalation. They're kind of in this like chronic surprise state. Should they be talking to a therapist? Should they be eating a handful of psilocybin and going and hang out in a tree for 6 hours and allowing have a Kundalini waking happen to them? Maybe not the latter part, you know, but the whole psychosomatic like mind body relationship bridge, I think is very fascinating. And I think you can create a lot of, well, I don't think, I absolutely 100% know you can create an immense amount of structural change through the psyche. You can enter the soma through the psyche and you can enter the psyche through the soma. Is there any, I think it would probably, it becomes kind of probably a semantic.
I think you're answering your own question. I mean, I think it depends on the person. Like when I show them a really, you know, funny show them a really funny video and start getting them to do rapid, you know, to laugh, which is the transversus abdominis starting to jostle things around and getting some mobility there, right? So it could be through the emotions. And then, you know, and that emotional breath signature can also lead to a structural signature change and so on. I mean, you and I speak a lot of the same language in terms of, you know, what we like, how we like to approach the body. But, you know, I have so many different ways of trying to support my people. So, you know, it can be through that tickle effect, or it could be allowing them to start to tell story, to start to talk. And, or it can just be, let's use our body. Let's turn off our story mind. Let's turn off our sort of hyperthinker mind here and start to feel what it feels like to roll the body against the ground. And then, oh, look, there's a ball there. See how you can roll yourself over that ball. I mean, there's so many different ways. I have 114 exercises in Body by Breath that are designed to really help people embody their body and be able to move in to breathing as a whole body expression rather than just a mental expression or rather than just a nose to lungs expression.
Yeah. For the sake of this conversation, because I think the psyche part is so vast and we could spend a really long time pulling up a bunch of stones around that and still probably be scratching our heads by the end of it. The mechanical part I enjoy because it's tangible, you know, like Ida Rolf has a quote. She says, we work with the body because it's what we can get our hands on. And so mechanistically speaking, for a person to start to think of their breath as being a really a whole body global experience, how does a person start to bring awareness into the foundation of breathing? Would the foundation of breathing be in their feet? Would their foundation of breathing be in their pelvic floor? The foundation of, like, where is the foundation of breathing for a person?
There's an exercise in the book called Witness Breath. And Witness Breath is borrowed from Zen practice. And that is just to watch breath as it occurs in the wild. So you be a little lab scientist and watch nature. You're the nature and you're also the lab scientist. And start to witness the breath behavior, right? And I would illuminate the touch, the physical touch of air. So I think of air as a transient organ. It's this thing that actually has pressure and shape. It moves in and it moves out. It's never yours to keep. It's absolutely this elemental, shape-shifting, ephemeral organ that is ever present. So I have people, or I'd have you start to increase your attention on that, right? The feeling of air at the openings of the nostrils. If you're able to breathe through your nose, that would be awesome. And get a sense of the temperature of the air. Also get a sense of, if you know anything about the structure of the nose, you've just got thousands of hairs. And so you can imagine the journey of the air being pried apart like a, you know, like a toddler's comb, a toddler's brush. You know, the toddlers are covered with, after sleep, their hair is all matted. And so what those hairs inside the nose do is they start to pick apart the air, oscillate it, and then inside your nose, you have these incredible structures called turbinates that end up spinning the air, exposing it to more moisture, exposing it to warmth, and then that air cascades down the trachea into the bronchi and dividing and dividing and dividing in the lungs until we get to these end fields with these tiny little 500,000 little tiny grape-shaped structures called alveoli. So from there, you then want to develop a sense of the tissues around the lungs as a reflection, a pressure reflection of that organ entering and exiting. And so there will be shape change, either in the immediate area of the ribs or below, like we talked about zone one. You might feel the gut shifting out and in. You might feel your waist expanding and falling in. You might feel your lower back pushing backwards and then pushing back into, or you might feel even more distant in your pelvic floor, a stretch and then a release. That would be somebody who has an expression of zone one. Or depending on, you know, where they're at, they might feel suction around their nose and their face. They might feel their eyes being pulled in and out. They might feel their throat being kind of vacuumed in and out, or the sides of their neck being pressurized and then relieved, which would be a little bit more some zone three activities. So that would be one of the ways I would guide people into awareness of breathing. And once we get an awareness of, okay, well, which zone is home? Am I home in zone one? Am I home in zone two? Or am I home in zone three? And none of these are wrong. It's just, where's the breath hanging out right now? Then that's where I would then direct us to work next in terms of self-myofascial release or movement-based exercises, so that we can have the facility to play in all three zones, but ideally hanging around more in zone one and zone two, because we don't really want to be stuck in a zone three panic, high stress breath.
That concept that I feel like you made up, because I haven't heard it before, of the breath being, or air being a transient organ, that's really cool. Did you make that up?
Yeah, it's in the book. I think I got it from, here's where I got it from. The fecal matter is a transient organ.
Sure.
But air also contains a microbiome. And don't make me go into detail on that, because I don't have enough data to support that. But there is a really interesting symmetry, I think, to bowel and lungs, right? We have this outlet in our anus, and then we have this inlet in our mouth, which is also an outlet. I guess the anus is also an inlet. But isn't that interesting? But it's never yours to keep, because the air is always then being processed in your vasculature, and you're always then ejecting what's no longer useful, that load of carbon dioxide. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, as you said that, I started to observe my breathing as though there was a body inside of my body, which really actually is like immediately changing every breath that I'm taking.
Every breath has shape to it. It has a signature. And even in, I don't know if you noticed in Body by Breath, when I script, there's about 30 different breathing exercises that are just breath-based, and they're written like on a treble clef. So I wrote them like a musical music writing. And that's a, anyway.
That's cool.
I'm glad you like that analogy, because to me, as a somanaut, it's just so juicy and expresses it perfectly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then let's play with the concept that perhaps the foundation, which this is obviously more semantics and not absolutely accurate, but let's say the foundation of breathing is through the doorway in which breath enters, which is, you know, the nose, hopefully, and occasionally the mouth if you're up in, like, you know, a higher output situation. But let's just call it the nose. How does a person start to organize their nasal passages in such a way to be able to allow a warm welcome to that transient organ called air to enter the body? Sorry for the poetry. So how do we breathe better through the nose, Jill?
Yeah, that's definitely a big question. I do want to just do a hat tip to James Nestor for kicking the door open on the mainstream for the value of nasal breathing, and then to my good friend Brian McKenzie for also breaking down the gear system. Brian McKenzie and Rob Wilson. So
I think McEwen as well has been a big deal.
Oh, for sure. Oxygen Advantage. Yes. Yeah. The Buteyko method.
Yeah.
breathing through one's nose is limited by structural challenges within the face and nose. And so anything that's really chronic, that really, you need to see a doctor to help you with that. You look at, you go to an ENT, you go to a rhinologist. There are certain things that may be able to be done in a non-invasive way or a non-surgical way. And those are things that I can speak to, but I certainly have a house here where I had a massive challenge with my own son and not being able to be a nasal breather for quite a while. And that story is in the book. But he had inflamed glands in his throat called tonsils that were blocking airway. And so he could not get good nasal breathing. And you can look at that in the book. But let's talk about what you can do. I mean, the simple thing is decongest your nose through. You could use pressure through exercises like the caudal maneuver, that you can draw the labia, the skin next to the nose apart. And that can help to traction the sinuses and start to clear air. So it's really rather light pressure. You want to just, if you stick your fingers just on the outside of your nasal folds, like your fingers are glue, you're not pressing in order to touch your gums. You know what I mean? You're not in deep. You're in the chubby cheek zone. And then you just traction outwards. And you would hold that for many, many minutes while nasal breathing. The third point of the caudal maneuver that I don't ever see done, I used to do this on my son, is I go to the ethmoid bone. And so I try to create a traction here, you know, kind of at that third eye in between the eyebrows. And so that, for sustained pressure for quite a long time, is really helpful to adjust the sinuses of the face and increase the possibility of nasal breathing. Side lying can be really helpful for decongesting the opposite side of the face. So, if you're like both nostrils are congested, then you can lie on one side, in a bed, support your head and rest for a while, and that will drain. You can get that side open. And then when you flip over to the other side, you just want to keep the caudal on the one side that was formerly closed, now open. So just little things like that.
Just doing that little bit, I mean, I've done this hundreds or thousands of times, but just doing that little bit there, I can notice a difference in my respiration.
Yeah, it's immediate. And then the sort of non-stressful way of doing that would be using tape. So using tape to traction the nose apart. You can get kinesio tape. They have all sorts of over-the-counter tapes. I never use tape. I'm always pretty open. But then they have nasal strips. So it's kind of not my favorite conversation. It's like tape or massage position. Those things can help decongest or allow for airflow. But if there's something like a very pitched septum, you really want to see if you can have that manipulated either by, the right type of professional.
Yeah. What do you think of the breath hold, like doing a long exhalation or just a normal exhalation, holding your breath, holding your nose, going for a walk, doing a little like stretch business, and then doing a strong inhalation through the nose? The suggestion is it increases nitric oxide production and kind of can open up some of the nasal passages. Are you familiar with that one? I got that from Buteyko stuff.
Yeah. That sounds great. It sounds like great. I think breath holds are awesome as a way of building endurance in both sides of the fence of, inhale suspension pressure or exhale, I call it vacation, the void of air. I think you can get a lot out of doing breath hold practices as long as it feels comfortable. And I think they're really interesting for attention. I think they're also very interesting for the effect that they have on the intercostals, the diaphragm, spinal muscles, all of it.
Yeah. How about getting into the nerve supply and getting into like the vagus nerve and things like humming or singing, or you mentioned laughing? Like, how do we start to tap into tonifying or supporting or stabilizing the nervous system for better breathing efficiency?
Well, I want to jump back real quick to the nitric oxide comment, because the other thing that releases nitric oxide into your bloodstream is frictioning fascia. So when you apply shear forces to your fascial tissues through massage or self-massage, that also has a way of deploying nitric oxide into your blood vessels. And that is very helpful for keeping and maintaining slickness throughout your vasculature. And of course, your nose is lined with vasculature as well. So I think you can supply nitric oxide through, nose breathing holds, but you can also get it systemically through self-massage. Regarding the vagus nerve, there's two chapters in my book covering the vagus nerve. I mean, really, the book is about creating novel ways of stimulating your parasympathetic system response, especially for people who are stillness averse, meaning, just trying to meditate in still positions can make people make a very large proportion of people very fidgety and anxious, and they avoid meditation because it's so uncomfortable. I mean, I think that it's also documented, it's estimated that up to 63% of people have this thing called relaxation-induced anxiety, which is like crazy. It's not crazy. It's that stillness creates a lot of discomfort in people's bodies, whether it's the pain of their body or the pain of their own thoughts, or it's in stillness we're no longer able to subdue and sublimate all the other unpleasantries that our brain and our soma are processing.
Yeah. I want to take a moment and talk about something that is near and dear to my heart, that is utilizing a bidet instead of toilet paper. Next time you sit down on the toilet, Tushy wants you to remember one thing. The time you're spending scrolling on your phone isn't giving you peace of mind, it's giving you a hemorrhoid. Men actually spend twice as long in the bathroom, and one of the leading causes of hemorrhoids is prolonged sitting on the toilet. Wiping with toilet paper will only irritate your bum that much more. The Tushy bidet cleans your butt with a targeted stream of fresh water, eliminating the need for painful wiping. Before using the Tushy bidet, I would shower literally after every poo. Since switching over to the Tushy bidet, I will literally never go back to toilet paper. I find it ridiculous and absurd, to be perfectly honest. It is just so much more gentle and refreshing, and it feels like a massage for your bum every time you defecate. I literally don't understand toilet paper. The Tushy bidet is a chemical-free way to clean your butt. Even if you use wet wipes, you're still smearing poop around and introducing nasty chemicals to your butt. If upon getting yourself a Tushy bidet, if you're not 155% satisfied, they'll give you your money back. No questions asked. And they have a 12-month warranty. Stop wiping your butt with toilet paper. It's stupid. It doesn't make sense. Join the 3 million butts who have already made the switch to Tushy. For a limited time, our listeners get 10% off your entire order when you use code ALIGN at checkout. That's 10% off your order at hellotushy.com using promo code ALIGN. That is spelled HELLOTUSHY.com. And then utilize the ALIGN promo code for 10% off.
The analogy that's coming up in my mind in there, sorry for interrupting you, but it's almost like it's like we have all these avoidance strategies and ways to suppress and kind of, I think, avoid our some of the deeper parts within ourselves. That can be a thing. Obviously, looking at your social media notifications or, eating food as a suppressant, like an emotional avoidant behavior. It feels to me, the analogy is popping up, is almost like when the water is rippling and there's a little bit of like muck on the top, you can't really see what's below. But if you allow the water to still long enough, suddenly you can start to see down what's like in the swamp, and some of those parts start to come to the surface. And if a person's ever done like Vipassana meditation as an example, that's their whole thing. It's just like, just sit through it. You literally don't need to do anything. Everything you've been reaching out for, all the resources, all the books, all the guides, all the everything, if you just sit with it and allow the intelligence of the body to come online, finally, suddenly that will just work its way through. I'm not saying that is like an objective absolute, but that's kind of the perspective of a lot of those like Eastern esoteric meditative practices. And I think that that's a lot of us live in the chop because we don't want to actually see what's down below. And if you sit with oneself for long enough, I think that chop starts to calm and those deeper parts start to come up. And, you know, I don't know. I think me personally, I don't always want to like look at those deeper parts. Anyways, that's another like esoteric.
Well, you've done the darkness meditation retreats. Uh-huh. I mean, I cannot think of something more totally disturbing to do than to be isolated in darkness, especially because I have two small children. Like, I just cannot imagine what would come up for me there. I mean, first I'd sleep a lot and then I'd be like, oh shit.
That's pretty much the cadence. You're right.
That's the cadence. Great. And then
that's the plan. You sleep for 14 hours and then you freak out for 4 days.
Okay. So now I'm totally distracted. I just distracted
myself. Sorry. Vegas nerve.
The Vegas. Yeah. So all the practices in the book are oriented to help enlarge your ability to tolerate a parasympathetic state. And the vagus nerve is your chief parasympathetic nerve. And so we can stimulate it in a variety of different ways so that we create a parasympathetic cascade. This parasympathetic cascade tamps down that sympathetic overflow. And ultimately, it slows down our heart rate, slows down our breath rate. It can make us salivate. It can make us have involuntary tears, not necessarily connected to anything. But these are some of the like symptoms of parasympathetic arousal. And so in some of the Eastern traditions, stillness is the top of the pyramid in terms of like, you know, Buddha nature and the establishment of still point. And I'm not going to argue whether that is the cherry or not, but I know that for many people, it has become something impossible. And so I want to provide exercises that can really help those people who are meditation averse, or that meditation just simply time after time has not been resourceful for them, or it hasn't been helpful for them, or at least in this stage of life. And so I use breath, rolling, and movement as in different doses and in different ways to help people build this parasympathetic tolerance, with this the ability to endure parasympathetic states, even though they may not be in a stillness state. So like, for example, yoga nidra or non-sleep deep rest is also heavily featured in the book as the fourth parasympathetic tool. But not all people feel comfortable just laying in stillness either. If you master these other three tools the way I've outlined, eventually that stillness will arise naturally and it won't feel so problematic. Yeah, because I'm getting back to your question about the vagus, but I'll be teaching in a room with 20, 30, 50, 100 people, and you'll tell them at the end, you know, lay down, close your eyes, relax. I'll guide them through maybe that transient organ witness breath that I talked you through earlier. And you'll see there'll be a lot of people kind of shrugging their shoulders or, you know, rolling their foot back and forth, just the inability to be still. So I wanted to address those people as well as everybody else who's lying in the room. So ways to arouse the vagus, I think through mechanical ways is a pretty cool thing for you and me because we like body work. You can stimulate the vagus through gut-based massage, visceral massage. So we do that, you know, with the gorgeous ball, have people lay in different unusual tolerable positions where they can press into the muscles of zone one, but also provide some visceral shift. And that's one way to stimulate the vagus and enter a calm state. Another place that the vagus innervates is the lungs.
Is there anywhere specific? Is just any pressure in around the gut cavity, or is there any specific places that would
be? Vagus innervates every single organ of your gut.
Yeah.
So you can't miss.
So any form of tummy massage is going to be a pretty regulating decision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that nice? Tummy massage.
I like tummy massage.
Yeah, go. Belly. Yeah. Sounds good. But I would say that you want to do it in a way that doesn't freak you out, or if you're doing it for somebody else, that doesn't make them feel threat. And so that is, you know, the reduction of sympathetic tone, the reduction of unconscious muscle bracing, or anything that throws off the alarm bells in their body. So what I show in the book and what I do in person is I'll have people do side-lying position. So they're lying with the cordis ball on their side, and then gradually increasing movements. You'll breathe into those shapes, and it eventually you just turn into kind of a gummy monster down there. It feels so good. The other place that you can target for vagal stimulation mechanically is the lungs. The entirety of the rib cage, your lungs are literally cased inside of the ribs. And so there are mechanical pressures that we can place on the ribs, anywhere along the ribs, and then induce different breathing strategies in there. And that can have an uptick in vagal activity as well. Along with that, some strategic breath holds can also trigger a vagal stimulation of the heart. When you're inhaling and holding your breath, the sympathetic nerves are dominant in terms of the heartbeat. But once you start to exhale, the sympathetic dies down and the vagus starts to become dominant, and that slows down the heart rate. So doing strategic breath holds, a little bit of pressure holds, plays around with the baroreceptor reflex that's just above the heart in the aortic notch. So that's another way that we can stimulate the vagus through, you know, the cordis ball pressurizing, different strategic breath holds in there. And then the third place is some different muscles of the face, neck, and head. Number one would be the side of the neck, where you can apply pressure along the carotid sheath, and you'll be able to actually maneuver the neurovascular bundle that contains the carotid artery, the jugular vein, and the insertion of the vagus into that exact area. Mechanical pressures there are very rigidly, they're a gate for the blood-brain barrier. So in other words, when you start to massage the side of the neck, the vagus will start to fire in order to prevent any extra bulging to happen, any extra blood to come up to the brain, because your brain has to guard its volume of blood very, very distinctly. And the vagus is that gatekeeper. So we play around with that mechanical pressure to stimulate the baroreceptor mechanically, but you can also just go a little bit upside down, like laying on your back and then lifting your pelvis higher than your heart, higher than your head. And this creates a little gentle slope. And that also stimulates the baroreceptors just through blood pressure, just through the weight of blood flowing towards your head. So I can either mechanically do it by using my hand or by using the cordis ball against the side of the neck. And those can all start to really put you into a more parasympathetic state. And then the last thing would be, I can massage muscles of the face, neck, and head with like some of the smaller yoga tune-up balls that I have. There's smaller grippy pliable rubber balls. But many of the muscles of the face and neck share source nuclei with the vagus nerve and the brainstem. And so, for example, the nerve that supplies the trapezius is the accessory nerve, and it's sharing this source nuclei with the vagus. And so when I massage, like everybody likes an upper trap massage. Like most people like, oh, I really like that. It really helps me relax. Well, partly it helps you relax because yes, you're stretching the fibers of the trapezius that are, you know, really tight. And so we're elongating them, and that can help to mitigate some of the sympathetic, you know, kind of grippy control of the muscles. But also there's this interplay with the vagus. So face massage, neck massage, these are all ways that can amplify vagal output.
I think it's really interesting. I know that you're very enamored and have a relationship with Stephen Porges, like whole polybagel.
Oh, I just love him. Yes.
Yeah. Neuro. I'd love to understand for folks, what is neuroception? How about just what is neuroception? There's other stuff that I want to ask, but starting with that.
So Dr. Stephen Porges is the first researcher to quantify heart rate variability. And even when you were hearing me talk about, when you're in an inhale stage, your heart rate is faster. When you're exhale, the vagus is dominant and it's slower. He was the first person to ever work the mathematical reality of that out. And so in the decades that have passed, he's come up with this theory about the vagus nerve, which is a huge nerve with hundreds of thousands of individual nerve fibers within it. And he calls this theory polyvagal theory. And you and I did a podcast on polyvagal theory, so maybe you should just link to it
and
break it all down.
That was years ago.
Yes. And you were here in the studio.
In the old studio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were right over.
You've always been so welcoming and sweet to me, and I'd imagine other people. It's very kind. Your vagus must be well regulated. It must be well sorted. Although I think at the time you were actually having some health issues, so you were still managing.
Oh, wait, always have health issues.
Duress.
We always have health issues, Aaron.
That's why you're so into all this stuff.
Oh my gosh, yes. I am a subject and I'm an object. Yeah. All right, so Dr. Porges talks about neuroception. It's like your spidey sense. He doesn't say that. I'm saying that. But it's your body's ability to sense safety or threat. And its responses, not your conscious responses. It's your body, like the hair standing on end all of a sudden when you walk into a certain room. It's the feeling of doom right before something bad happens. Like you don't know why, but your body does. It's like it's the canary in the coal mine. It's your animal sensing, being able to pick up on things before it's conscious. So
it's like your subconscious translating the millions or billions of bits of information, all the time, and then we have the conscious mind kind of driving things, telling us, oh, we should go left or go right. But then there's the iceberg below the surface that is the subconscious. It's translating all of this information of subtle facial gestures, or like voice prosody would be a term that they would use, or, you know, body language, or like all of the different subtle little cues that are kind of pulling on the subconscious mind that send this ripple of information into the conscious. I don't know. I think that was too many words, but sorry.
Yeah, no, I think everything you're saying is right. You know, he has an institute now. He founded it in 2020 with Deb Dana. And so they have a lot of different practitioners, both in the mental health space, the movement space, massage space, that are amalgamating different applications of polyvagal theory, you know, in the workplace, in these different fields of interest, because I think he's really on to a really great model for us to see behavior. And his other part of the neuroception is, or polyvagal theory in general, is that our species designed to co-regulate with other beings. If we didn't evolve to be in isolation, and we evolved to have group safety as well. And so the neuroception serves a protective function to keep us out of harm.
So something that I'm very interested in, and something that I've said, you know, a lot of times, is I don't talk about like body work on this podcast really hardly at all, but I do various different forms of body work. And something
Aaron's
that I really
so good, you guys. Aaron's body work is so good. This man is incredible.
That's really kind. That's a massive compliment from you. And so thank you. And something that I've said lots and lots of times is I really enjoy working with the body because it's so honest. And, you know, words, it's very easy for a word to lie, but underneath that, there's all the neuroceptive parts of the tone of the language and the pacing of the language and intonation and voice prosody and facial gestures and body language. Like, that's how we're actually communicating to it. We're actually physically communicating to each other. And when you actually put hands on a body and you can feel the tone of the nervous system and the hydration of the connective tissue and the old postural patterns that may have been there since God knows how long, and the respiratory patterns, like, oh my God, this person is stuck in an inhalation. Like, they're only able to breathe up into this, you know, third quadrant or third phase of breathing, like you said.
Third zone, yeah.
And that, and then, but on top of that, they're like, oh yeah, I'm fine. Everything's great. I'm amazing. Best ever. It's like, well, your body is saying this and your words are saying this. Finding consilience between the two probably would be a beautiful thing. How specifically, is there some way, I've asked you this before, and I've been trying to like wrangle this as a concept and idea for a long time. But is there some way to, like, a one-to-one relationship or way to translate tone of the muscles in around the neck or muscles in around the face or muscles around the diaphragm or pelvic floor or any of that into actual, like, personality traits or expressions or thoughts or feelings?
Oh, Aaron, wouldn't that be nice? not that I know of. I mean, I'm thinking of some research. There was some research in 2020. It's in, I wrote a paper. Ah, no, it wasn't in there yet. Was it? So I wrote a chapter for a medical textbook called Fascia Function and Medical Applications. And we're going to second edition. I just turned in my second edition of the chapter. And what is now, so mental health, so fascia and mental health is like a new, it's a new chapter. There isn't a lot of research there yet. And there was one mental health hospital, like a residential mental health hospital in Germany, that did some studies on the elasticity of fascial tissues in people with major depressive disorder. And so they have this tool called, it sounds so crazy, the indentometer. So the indentometer is a probe that probed, I believe it was the upper traps that they actually probed into of these folks who are hospitalized with major depressive disorder. And what they found in these patients is that the connective tissue was very, it took a long time for it to refill. So when connective tissue is pressed, it basically just reperfuses, right? So if it's very unhealthy, it's going to take longer for fluids to then be able to reperfuse in that area. It's like sticky, it's stiff. And so they had an inordinate amount of stiffness in their connective tissue. So take that as you will. With those people, they also found that rolling helped them. It changed their affect and outlook. So that's cool, right? But I mean, whenever I roll, it changes my affect and outlook also. And I don't have, that I know of, major depressive disorder. But I like that the people with major depressive disorder had an uptick in their outlook from rolling. So further research is needed. So that's all I've got for you on that.
Well, that's fine. Is that something you think, I won't go too far, but do you ever, is that something you think about at all? Like the translations of the body into something, like, could there be some AI device or just a person? I think this is neuroception, where we are the AI devices, that would actually be able to translate postural patterns and tone of specific muscles, which ultimately translates to postural patterns, into emotions, you know, or feelings or intentions.
I think Reich did that. Reich had made that machine. I'm totally blanking on what it is, but and then he was like jailed. He's like put in jail.
You know, it's good if they get put in jail.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, they're onto something.
Trying to figure that out. I mean, you're a body worker. You've been in a lot of people's bodies. But I think what's confounding is that collagen, so this goes back to when we've talked about fascia before, but, you know, fascia, it has different stiffness in so many different qualities of stiffness in different bodies based on their genetics, not necessarily based on are they a happy person or are they a sad person. I think there's just so many different things that go into it. And then even in your own house, you have parts of your body that, like, you know, your elbow got shredded in a tractor accident when you were 9. And he's like, well, I'm a really happy person, but I got a, you know, an elbow that doesn't straighten all the way. Not me, but you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So yeah.
I think it would be less like the kind of like the simplistic emotions of like happy or sad. And probably the broader binary nature of the nervous system would be like safe and unsafe. You know what I mean? I think it's like if a person feels unsafe, they feel like they need to guard and protect. If they feel like they need to guard and protect, then they're going to brace. Bracing translates to contraction. Contraction, excessive chronic contraction translates to tissue dehydration. And you kind of just become like this dam stuck up in yourself. And you don't allow the world to come in and out. You just kind of bunker down and hold it in. And then as a person starts to feel more safe, just like a child, if a child feels safe enough with their parents or primary caregivers, then they'll have a higher likelihood of wandering out beyond the fence and exploring and meeting new people. And then they come back and they inform their parents, like, this is what happened. Whereas if they don't actually feel safe within that anchor of the primary caregivers or perhaps anchor within themselves, then they'll probably just batten down the hatches and stay inside. Anyways. I'll come off of the metaphors.
I absolutely see what you're saying.
Yeah, sorry, Jill. So coming back into structure function stuff, how does a person start to come into relation with something as obscure as the pelvic floor? And is that a relevant place to come into relation to in the conversation of respiration?
Yes, it's the bottom of the funnel of the pressure of the diaphragm's, you know, main exertion within the trunk. So your pelvic floor should have a reciprocal relationship when you inhale in a relaxed state. As the diaphragm descends, the pelvic floor will also descend, and as you exhale, those will go up. Just kind of like that simple. So if I've got a rigid pelvic floor, if for some reason I'm holding it in all the time, squeezing my butt cheeks together in a kind of a chronic Kegel, maybe I've had scarring in the pelvic floor from surgery, anal surgery, vaginal surgery, or from, you know, being kicked or traumatized, you know, there might be a chronic tension there. And so that tension will filter into the low abdominals, SI joint, most likely. And it may be difficult for me to get a really calm state breathing.
Would there be any takeaway exercise a person could utilize to start to bring some more suppleness to the old anus? I'd be interested in
the actual anus or to the pelvic floor?
No, the whole pelvic floor. The whole structure, the whole trampoline.
Great. Yes. Yeah. Very simple. Yeah.
What do we do?
Well, one, you can start by sitting on a gorgeous ball or any inflated ball and try to keep your spine in as excellent alignment as you can and breathe and attempt to feel the reach of the breath stretching into the ball. And follow along, just like we were following along earlier, witness breath. We want to feel what's the ripple effect of pressure into the pelvic floor. And then we would do different contractions and then different angles and different positions down there. I've got a really good pelvic floor exercise in the Body by Breath book. We start there on the gorgeous ball. You can even deflate the gorgeous ball a little bit. And then we graduate to the smaller balls, the yoga tune-up balls, literally fits inside of the four bones that make the bony landmarks of the pelvic floor. So you have your pubic symphysis, you have your coccyx, you have your two ischial tuberosities. You can sit on the yoga tune-up ball and do different breath patterns, different leanings, different contractions of the different muscles of the pelvic floor. And that's a really great place to gain elasticity.
Yeah. What role does the psoas act in respiration or play in respiration?
The psoas is stitched to the diaphragm via a fascial connector called the medial arcuate ligament. And so the quadratus lumborum, which is its neighbor to the outside, is also stitched to the diaphragm with another connective tissue junction called the lateral arcuate ligament. So you have these fascial bridges connecting the diaphragm to both the psoas and this other muscle, the quadratus lumborum. But for the psoas connects all the way down into the upper femur. I mean, it's this massive muscle that crosses over the hip, the pelvis, the lumbar spine. It's holding on to the diaphragm, almost like a parachutist holding on to the cables of the parachute. And so when you think about the hip's relationship to breathing, the psoas is that link. So if I have chronic tension, you always go to tension here. If I have chronic tension in one or other of my psoas because maybe I took a football hit on one side of my body, and forever that psoas is just a little bit holding on to that impact, or maybe I've had hip surgery like I had a total hip replacement, then the psoas might be in a shortened position. That shortened position can transfer mechanical pressures to the diaphragm as well. And so we want to have that be a slippery relationship or an elastic relationship rather than a relationship that is inhibiting hip range. So I really stumbled my way through that in an inarticulate way, but your hip's range of motion and your psoas's ability to both elongate and to shorten has direct connection to the movement of the diaphragm, and especially into where it has that connection.
Yeah, I love that. All right, final thing. What do you mean when you say the diaphragm is like the second mind?
Well, I don't mean the diaphragm is your second mind. I think somebody else said that, and I quoted them, I think.
What could that mean? Diaphragm. How could the diaphragm pose or act as the second mind? What could that mean?
So the nerve that supplies the diaphragm is called the phrenic nerve, and in Greek, phren means mind. And so who knows whether they named the phrenic nerve because they saw it coming out of the brainstem, they're like, oh, mind nerve. And then it goes to the diaphragm, which the diaphragm is, you know, contracting and doing its thing. But I think we can be poetic about it and consider that the diaphragm is always reflecting the state of the mind. Right? If I'm anxious, I'm going to have a short, shallow breathing pattern. If I'm in a calm state, I'm going to probably have slower respiration and a not stressful breathing pattern.
Yeah. I love you.
Okay.
I'm really grateful that you exist. I really appreciate just all the work that you put into investigating and understanding this human experience.
Oh, you're welcome. I think there's probably some better answers than I was able to articulate actually in the book.
Mm-hmm. So Body by Breath, I think it's an incredible book. I'm like really grateful it exists. I think it's something that would be like a great staple just to have in a house and could plan on picking at it for the rest of your life. You'd probably keep on learning things. So I'm a big fan. I really appreciate you putting 8 years of your life into pouring yourself and your education and your experience and all that into one resource for the rest of us. So thank you.
Thank you. And you know what I spent another year doing, Aaron?
What's that?
Filming every single one of the exercises that's in Body by Breath. So the 114 exercises are now indexed in a library on my website. So if people are like, I love reading an exercise in a book and then trying it, which is probably not most people, they'd rather be led.
Right.
We have filmed them beautifully into individual little segments so people can look in the book and they're like, wait a minute, I'd rather Jill lead me through that. They can head to the website.
So the book is Body by Breath. What's the website?
TuneUpFitness.com.
Cool. All right. Anything else before we go? You pick up your Ninos?
Yes. It was a pleasure talking to you. As always, Aaron, it's really fun. I love it when you really get what I'm trying to deliver. So it's a real pleasure.
I feel like I'm like running after. I'm like at your heels. I'm like trying to keep up with the stuff that you're putting together. So I really appreciate it. Well, cool. Thank you, Jill. Thank you all for tuning in. That's it. That's all. I'll see you next week. Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. If you did and you want to see the video version of that, that would be great because we did a lot of exercises that you could actually see. Jump over to the Align Podcast YouTube page, subscribe over there so you get each week's video episode of this as well as other instructional content. Thanks for reviews. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for joining you. I'll see you next week.